Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. This evening, Charlie and many of his National Review colleagues embark on the National Review cruise to Scandinavia. So in between putting in his shuffleboard stick and his cruise wear, Charlie has graciously agreed to join us today. Charlie, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Doing great, doing great. Good, bad, and crazy martinis as always. Let's start with the good. And Charlie, of course, the Republican Party wringing its hands ever since Mitt Romney's loss to President Obama about why it lost. And one of the big conclusions it came up with earlier in the year is that it's doing a horrible job reaching out to Hispanics. And as the demographics shift, that's going to become a bigger and bigger problem. Their main effect of that report is to push for comprehensive immigration reform, which we're not big fans of here. But we have some encouraging news, perhaps, from a special state Senate race in California's Central Valley. California is a deep blue state. This has been a deep blue district because it's 60% Hispanic, and the Democrats have pretty much held this easily cycle after cycle. But in this special election, a Republican, and a white Republican at that, Andy Vidak, I think is how you say his name, he's a cherry farmer, he's a cattle rancher, he's fluent in Spanish, and it seems like he just went out there, met with people, understood where they were coming from. It says that he focused on job creation, affordable energy, opposition to big government. There's some dispute as to how big of an issue legalization for illegals was in this campaign. He says it was certainly a factor. Others who campaigned on his behalf said not so much. He even went out to big Hispanic festivals, cooked menudo, which is not Ricky Martin's band, but a cow stomach soup, and apparently a Mexican favorite. So he understood who was in his district. He went out and met with them on their level, talked about the issues that mattered to him and apparently to them as well, because he won, Charlie. So the question is this a special election in a state Senate race that is unique to that district, or are there lessons here for the National Party?
I don't know. I think this is a fairly complex issue, California. What I would say is you can't win where you don't compete. And since 1994, a combination of factors, partly the 86 amnesty, changing demographics, and the 1994 initiative, which was largely regarded as being anti-immigrant in California, Republicans have tended to lose. And really, they've ceded a state that they historically won. I think California went Republican in every single year from, I think I'm right in saying, 1936 to 1992, with the exception of when Goldwater ran against Johnson. And now California is one of those states that Republicans just tick off at the beginning of an election season. They don't spend money there. And in some regards, that really is a mistake, because there's nothing particular about Californians that makes them allergic to conservatism or to libertarianism. So it's actually nice to see someone competing in the first place. Can he expand that? There are a lot of challenges. I certainly don't think that just because an area is heavily Hispanic, then conservatism can't win. Although the way in which the Democratic Party has leveraged this debate over immigration against the Republican Party so effectively does present a challenge. And I'm not convinced that that would change after any sort of comprehensive bill. I think conservatives are right to feel worried about that, in that Democrats will then say, well, we'd like to reduce the amount of time one has to wait for citizenship to 7 years. Republicans will cry foul and they'll say, look at them, they hate you, and so on. The point at which Hispanics and Southern Californians start voting for Republicans will be the point at which those attacks ring hollow. So it's certainly encouraging. Will it lead to a change in that state? Who knows?
Certainly the ground game, it appears, was very strong in this campaign. It appears that they've met with folks in their living rooms, really listened well. And whether that will translate on a statewide or national scale, who knows? But that's pretty much what you need to do to get anybody's vote. Hopefully at least that part of the lesson gets through before this devolves into a big discussion over legalization. On to martini number two now, and we flinch at the idea of any sort of comprehensive bill. We usually flinch also at the quote-unquote grand bargain. That term got thrown around a lot in the summer of 2011 when the last major debt ceiling debate took place. We thought there might be a grand bargain before the fiscal cliff at the beginning of this year. No such luck. But the president, not giving up on this idea, he's going to Chattanooga, Tennessee today, and he's going to offer up another grand bargain. He will propose a cut in corporate tax rates, which USA Today says, of course, is a priority for Republicans, in exchange for a significant investment in middle-class jobs. And that's the terminology used by Obama senior advisor Dan Pfeiffer. The response from House Speaker John Boehner's spokesman is, this proposal allows President Obama to support President Obama's position on taxes and President Obama's position on spending while leaving small businesses and American families behind. If there is a tax cut, Charlie, it's obviously not the worst martini we've ever had, but it seems like the president's appetite for more spending has not gone down any since we've been in the sequester.
No, well, that characterization is precisely what it is, because for all his love of taxes, the president is actually in favor of cutting the corporate tax rate. The problem is that the president doesn't want to cut the corporate tax rate in the way that a conservative or a libertarian would want to cut the corporate tax rate. The president wants to change the tax system and the spending system so that it resembles more of a European-style regime. For example, in England, where the middle class end up benefiting from huge spending and then are told that they have to pay for it, which is not what we've seen in America. Republicans, I think wisely, although it does hurt them as well, have been loath to add any more revenue to the government's coffers because they know what will happen. And the president here is really saying, look, I want another stimulus, and that's what this is. And in return, I'm happy to cut the corporate tax rate. Well, if you do the math on that, that's just going to lead to more deficit and to more debt. So it neither satisfies the Obama endgame, which is to move to a system in which the middle class are paying for services provided by the government through taxation, nor does it satisfy the Republicans' endgame, which is to cut taxes and cut spending so that the government is ultimately smaller. In that regard, I really can't see it going anywhere.
One of the initial major media reports was, White House makes another offer to Republicans. Republicans reject with no alternative.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I find particularly irritating in the coverage of Congress. You know, for example, last year, what you've just described is precisely what happened with the Ryan plan. The Republicans offered the Ryan plan. The White House rejected it, as did the Senate. And they're entirely within their rights to do that. And then offered nothing in return. It's the same story with budgets over the last few years. It's the same story with this immigration bill, is that supposedly the House is duty-bound now to take up S-744 because the Senate passed it. So the story is always, you know, Democratic Senate offers bill, Republicans do nothing. But you can look at that the other way around as well and say the House keeps repealing Obamacare, but the Senate never takes that up. But the story is never, you know, Republicans do something constructive in Congress and the Senate Democrats ignore it. So sure, that will be the narrative, but that's not really what's happened here at all.
All right, on to martini number three now. And Charlie has actually written a column on this topic, which you can find at nationalreview.com. And for those who have been paying attention, even those who haven't really, most probably are aware that there is a new 9/11 Memorial Museum. But there's a controversy now as a result of a new book on the whole battle for Ground Zero, is the title of this book. It's written by Elizabeth Greenspan. And I think most people who remember 9/11 remember the iconic photo of the recovery workers finding this flagpole and lifting it up in an image that was kind of reminiscent of the flag raising at Iwo Jima back in World War II. And it was kind of a capsule of the way America felt at that time, rising from the rubble, resilient, stirred an incredible wave of patriotism, which would have happened anyway, but certainly fed into that. And now we find out, and this is from the New York Post, the iconic picture of firefighters raising the stars and stripes in the rubble of Ground Zero was nearly excluded from the 9/11 Memorial Museum because it was rah-rah American. Michael Shulin, the museum's creative director, was among staffers who considered the Tom Franklin photograph too kitschy and rah-rah American. And the story goes on to explain that the photo potentially, according to Mr. Shulin, would have simplified what happened on 9/11. Ultimately, he agreed to having multiple angles of the same photo rather than having that one apparently simplistic shot, Charlie. So apparently American patriotism in the face of a heinous attack is questionable?
Well, he hit sort of the progressive snobby trifecta here in that he said that he was bothered by the rah-rah America instinct, as you quoted. And he put that slightly differently as well in the same. He's quoted as saying that the way America will look best, the way we can really do best, is not to be Americans so vigilantly and so vehemently. And then he also said that 9/11 was a much more complex issue than this photograph suggested. Now, My view on this is that when the self-appointed arbiters of taste in a nation start to think like that, the nation is in trouble. You can survive as a country war and depression and natural disasters, but you can't survive a wholesale disintegration of self-confidence. And Mr. Shulin is unfortunately indicative of a certain worldview that the United States is a problem in that it is too assertive and that it is too pleased with itself and that it views itself in too good a light. I really can't begin to imagine at what point in American history one should be vigilantly and vehemently American than at the point at which one has been attacked brutally by barbarians flying airplanes into buildings. Who also is supposed to be reluctant or reticent at a point at which firefighters are saving innocent people who have nothing whatsoever to do with foreign policy, whatever Mr. Shulin's views are on that? As I say, this becomes problematic for a country when people in that position are not on board with the country's defense. And I just ask, why on earth is he the curator of the museum?
That's a great question. When he's so uninterested, apparently, in capturing the mood at the time and the reaction of the American people and the reaction of the people who are right there digging through the rubble trying to find their own friends, it's kind of hard to understand why you wouldn't be a little more favorable towards that iconic impression from the days following 9/11.
You know, I draw fire sometimes because I'm fairly open about my Western culturism, and I'm quite happy to say that the Western world is morally superior to the rest of it. I'm quite happy to say that within that, the Anglosphere is exceptional, and within the Anglosphere, America is exceptional. Now, that doesn't mean that America is perfect. It doesn't mean that America never does anything wrong. But it does mean that one should be aware of the beauty and the virtue of the place in which one lives. And this ultimately is a memorial to the innocent people who were killed in an unprovoked act of aggression. It's little more and it's little less. It's not a paper on American foreign policy. It's not a museum designed to capture both sides of a reasonable argument. It is a memorial to 3,000 people who died when savages flew airplanes into our buildings. There isn't much moral gray area here, especially given that this is a genuine, not a fabricated photograph of something that actually happened on that day. I can't see the argument of not including it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Charlie, thank you very much for filling in today. And on a lighter note, good luck against Jim Garrity in the limbo contest on board the ship.
I don't think I have a chance. I'm 6'3" as well. He's got me beat.
Charlie, have a great time. Enjoy the time with your colleagues and your guests and your readers, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We'll be back on Wednesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.